Good afternoon. We have as our third case this morning, as our third case today, and every March argument, 98-2162, Linda Green v. Smith & Nephew A.H.P. Inc., arguing on behalf of the defendant, Smith & Nephew, is Joseph Jerry.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abramson, and may it please the Court. My name is Joseph Kearney, and I represent defendant Smith & Nephew. This case involves the unprecedented conclusion that a product is defective solely because it causes some users to become allergic. No previous appellate court has ever reached that result. The jury reached that conclusion here because it was told not to consider undisputed facts that this court has said are of the sort that juries should consider in appropriate product liability cases. First, that Smith & Nephew's latex gloves are an extremely useful product that promotes public health by preventing the spread of blood-borne diseases such as AIDS. Second, that Smith & Nephew could not have known of the risk of latex allergy at the time in question. And third, that most people who develop latex allergy experience only very minor symptoms or none at all. By ignoring these crucial facts and by adopting a rule that effectively imposes absolute liability whenever a product poses unexpected risks, the lower courts have not only placed Wisconsin outside the mainstream of products liability law, they have also deviated from established Wisconsin products liability law. We raise four separate errors. Let me turn first to the allergy question, because that error entitles us to judgment. The Court of Appeals stands alone as the only appellate court ever to find a product defectively designed simply because it caused an allergy. Every other court to have addressed allergy, and both the third and the second restatements, recognize that a manufacturer can be liable for allergy only if there was a duty to warn and a failure to fulfill that duty. Because a duty to warn arises only where the manufacturer knew or should have known of the risk of allergy, plaintiff recognized that such a claim could not be pursued here, and instead argued that Smith & Nephew's gloves were defective and unreasonably dangerous because they could cause allergy. The Wisconsin law in this area, as stated in federal diversity cases, is clear, and it is the uniform rule elsewhere as well, that a product is not defectively designed solely because it can cause allergy. The Court of Appeals should be reversed and judgment entered for Smith & Nephew. Second, and independently of its error with respect to allergy, the Court of Appeals misconstrued Wisconsin products liability law in a way that, if left uncorrected, threatens vastly to expand products liability for manufacturers and for their insurance companies. Indeed, it promises to make manufacturers into insurers against any harm caused by their products. The Court of Appeals did this by ignoring this court's teaching in Sumnick versus Toyota that in appropriate cases, whether a product is defective should be judged by all of the circumstances. Instead, the lower courts here adopted a rule under which all that matters is whether the product deviated from the expectations of an ordinary consumer. This is a far-reaching error. The lower court's fundamental mistake was focusing on a single sentence in Sumnick, this court's statement that Wisconsin is committed to the consumer contemplations test, to the exclusion of the rest of the opinion. This court made very clear in Sumnick that the single factor of consumer contemplations should be supplemented in appropriate design defect cases with analysis of a variety of other factors. As the court explained, and these are the court's...
Did you ask for all of those tests at the trial court?
We asked for the pattern jury instruction, and the pattern and jury's instruction would have instructed the jury to consider reasonableness with regard to our product. We did ask for this. It is important to remember that in asking for the pattern jury instruction, and in the court's refusing to give us the pattern jury instruction, what happened is that the court took out the first sentence of the pattern instruction, which would have instructed the jury to inquire whether our product was reasonably fit for ordinary use. And by redefining defectiveness solely in terms of consumer contemplations, the trial court reduced the entire inquiry, both for defect and for unreasonable danger. And it is essential that I am clear on this point. The circuit court reduced the inquiry for both defect and unreasonable danger solely to consumer expectations. Unreasonable danger was already defined in terms of consumer expectations in the pattern instruction, and so by redefining defect only to include consumer expectations, there was nothing left other than consumer expectations. The Court of Appeals affirmed this. The Court of Appeals, when plaintiff raised an argument that we had not asked for this in the circuit court, thought nothing of that argument and went right ahead and held that the circuit court was correct, as we submit that it was not, in redefining the test solely in terms of consumer expectations.
Counsel, it isn't clear to me, first of all, I guess what is clear to me is you want us to adopt Restatement 30, is that correct?
No, we want you to apply Summit. We want existing Wisconsin law. We do not need the Restatement 3rd. We do not need any change in Wisconsin law. We need what the court said in Sumner beyond the sentence where it said that Wisconsin is committed to the consumer contemplation
okay.
test.
Counsel, if I may. Apparently there's a disagreement as to Sumner and what it stands for. One sentence from Sumner says Wisconsin is committed to the consumer contemplation test for determining whether a product is defective. The standard jury instruction, of course, has the consumer contemplation test for whether a product is unreasonable. Now, it seems to me you're arguing on other language of Sumner that it isn't exclusively the consumer expectation test, but there should be, I suppose, risk utility involved in it, too.
There should be factors that go to a consideration of reasonableness. And consider what else the court said in Sumner beyond the statement that Wisconsin is committed to the consumer contemplation test. The court also said, since product defects are unique in each case, this is pages 371 to 372 of Sumner, since product defects are unique in each case, the factors that will be beneficial in assessing defectiveness and unreasonableness will differ from case to case. And then the court went on to list, on page 372, in a block quotation, the factors that can be considered in proper cases, and they have nothing to do with consumer contemplation. They have to...
So I say, okay, there's an argument as to what Sumner stands for. Does it stand for saying Wisconsin is committed to the consumer contemplation test for determining defect, or is it not? And you can pick and choose the language you want. I know in reading the comments to the Restatement Thirds, it labeled Wisconsin as one of those jurisdictions that was committed to the consumer expectation test solely, exclusively. So do you disagree with the commentators to the Restatement Third when they classify Wisconsin's current law as committed solely to the expectation of the consumer test?
Absolutely. That is not a correct reading of current Wisconsin law.
So the commentators to the Restatement of Thirds are incorrect when they interpret Wisconsin law that way.
To the extent that they say that, and I understand from you that they do, yes, that is an incorrect statement of Wisconsin law, because there is no way that you can read the rest of Sumner and come to the conclusion that Wisconsin will apply a consumer expectations test in every case. Not only is there the statement that the factors that will be considered in determining defect and unreasonableness will differ from case to case, but the court then went on to state what some of those factors ought to be in appropriate cases. And they pointed to such things as conformity of the defendant's design to practices of other manufacturers in its industry at the time of manufacture, the period of time involved in such use by the claimant and others prior to the injury without harmful incident, the ability of the manufacturer to eliminate danger, and the relative likelihood of injury resulting from the product's present design. All of that is at 121 Wisconsin 2nd at 372.
I look again at those comments, and I'm looking in restatement third, and it lists, I guess, a number of states that, in contrast to other states that have risk utility or a blend of expectation risk utility, apparently the commentators to restatement third think that Alaska, Arkansas, Hawaii, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and Wisconsin are examples of consumer expectations only.
That is not a correct statement of Wisconsin law.
Now, that's the Sumnet opinion says that two separate approaches have emerged to evaluate design defects. Now, you view this as a design defect case?
This is a design defect case.
Not a manufacturing issue?
No.
Okay.
And even plaintiff no longer contends, as it once did, that this is purely a manufacturing defect case.
So it then says two separate approaches have emerged to evaluate design defects, a consumer contemplation test and a danger utility test. And then it describes danger utility test with the danger outweighing utility. It defines consumer contemplation test is the defectively dangerous if it's dangerous to an extent beyond which would be contemplated by the ordinary consumer who purchased it.
Right? Yes.
And then it says, Wisconsin is committed to the consumer contemplation test for determining whether a product is defective, period.
Yes, and then it goes on page 371 to 72 by emphasizing that because product defects are unique in each case, the factors that will be beneficial in assessing defectiveness and unreasonableness will differ from case to case. Let me explain our view of what the Sumnet Court meant when it talked both about being committed to the consumer contemplation test and all of these other factors on pages 371 to 372. We believe that what the Wisconsin Supreme Court was doing in the 1984 Sumnet case was anticipating the course that was later taken in other states, most notably by the California Supreme Court in the Sewell case. This is the 1994 Sewell versus General Motors case, where the California Supreme Court said the consumer contemplation test is appropriate for some cases, but it simply does not work where, and these are Sewell's words, the alleged defect involves a matter beyond the common experience and understanding of ordinary users. This is at 882 Pacific 2nd, page 309, footnote 5. Mechanical application of the consumer contemplation test, where, as here, consumers have no expectation concerning latex allergy and no expectation concerning protein levels, results in a situation in which, as one of the treatises that is cited by the amicus brief says, it can be readily found through hindsight in almost any case that a defect existed wherever someone sustained an injury from the use of a product. And we submit that by going into the factors that may be appropriate in particular cases, Sumnet makes clear that such a mechanical approach is not Wisconsin law. And let me also note that the plaintiff recognizes that there must be a reason that the Wisconsin Supreme Court went ahead in the Sumnet case and simply did not stop with consumer contemplations. And what the plaintiff says is not that these factors can never be used, but the plaintiff says these factors are clearly permissive in the words of Sumnet. That is true. But what the plaintiff fails to tell the court is when a jury should be permitted to consider the relevant factors identified in Sumnet. And there must be such cases, because if you look only at consumer expectations, then you make manufacturers into insurers subject to absolute liability for any product that causes an unexpected injury. And who expects to be injured by a product? Consideration of the Sumnet factors is designed to avoid that result, as numerous opinions from this court have said the product's liability law must.
Now, do we agree that there are two factors? One, that it has to be defective, and then it has to be unreasonably dangerous?
We do agree.
Okay. So why do you have to put this danger outweighing utility into defective condition when you have it under unreasonably dangerous?
We did not have it under unreasonably dangerous.
Well, I mean, under Sumnet, you might be able to do that.
You have to have it in one place or the other, and Sumnet talks about it with regard to both. But by approving a jury instruction that collapsed both defect and unreasonable danger into solely a one-factor test, what the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals did here was to read everything else out of this case, including concepts of reasonableness, other than consumer expectations.
Well, one of the problems I have, and I've reread Sumnet and I reread the restatement second, they put the same consumer contemplation into unreasonably dangerous as they do into a defective condition.
They do talk about consumer contemplations with regard to both, but nowhere does the restatement, and nowhere has this court ever indicated that it is appropriate in all cases to reduce both of those to the single factor of consumer contemplation. And in Sumnet, the court, in fact, indicated that it's not appropriate.
Okay. Is it appropriate in any case to reduce
those? Yes. And this is the virtue of our theory and why we have an ability to demonstrate to the court that consumer contemplation has a continuing role. We submit
in which aspect? Unreasonably dangerous or defect design?
Under defective design is the place where it makes the most sense to put it, but if you want to put it under unreasonably dangerous, it may go there as well. The important point is that in certain cases, it is appropriate to use only consumer contemplation. Well, what are those cases? Those are cases where the product has failed in its basic functions. The product has failed to perform its basic functions as an ordinary consumer would anticipate, because a consumer has expectations about basic functions. So if the allegation in this case were, as it is not, that our latex gloves had failed to perform their function of acting as barrier protectors, then consumer contemplations alone might well be enough to condemn our product as defective and unreasonably dangerous. This is the very point that the California Latex Gloves Court, whose decision we append to our main brief in this case, made when it applied the Sewell case, California's analog to Sumnet, to latex gloves. But here, the allegations go to an incidental aspect of the product's design and performance. And it cannot be said that the ordinary consumer had any expectation about that aspect of the product unless it was the general expectation that the product would not make him ill.
Well, let's test that for a minute. If I understood you right, you would use consumer contemplation for design defect when the product fails in its basic function.
Yes.
So you have a can opener, right? And it opens cans fine most of the time. In fact, all the time. But it has, because of something in it, if it's placed close to flames, it blows up. So it does not fail in its basic function. It's just fine. It just has a design defect that will ultimately make it unreasonably dangerous. So now the consumer contemplation, do you think that as to design defect, the consumer contemplation test would work?
The consumer contemplation test would probably not be appropriate there, but let me make clear.
Why not?
Because if the...
I mean, it fits what you said, your definition.
Well, if the can opener were performing its basic function of opening cans, then, and if it were not defective or unreasonably dangerous in that sense, then we don't believe that the consumer contemplations test would be appropriate. But let me point out what would happen if you applied the reasonableness factors in Sumnet to that case. There is very little that the defendant could put on its side of the scale with regard to reasonableness. We are not talking about a product in this case that is a can opener. We are talking about a product that had very substantial public health benefits in stopping the spread of bloodborne diseases. We submit that the jury...
If you look in my house, a can opener would be very important.
In terms of social utility, in terms of keeping products on the market that serve a substantial public benefit, certainly latex gloves are a product that this court and the courts of other states does not want to lightly condemn as dangerous and unreasonably dangerous in effect. Let's take the example of milk. We now know that certain people are lactose intolerant. They don't produce a particular enzyme that would help them to digest the sugar in milk. This is some 30 to 50 million people in this country. This causes physical ailments. We now know all of this. But when society and milk producers first learned about the risk of lactose intolerance, because it was not always known, would the law have recognized a massive class action against milk producers for producing a product that was defective and unreasonably dangerous solely because no one expected to become ill? Perhaps so, but if that were the case, we submit that the inability of milk producers to be aware of the risk of lactose intolerance is something that a jury could appropriately consider in deciding whether or not to condemn the product as defective and unreasonably dangerous.
Counsel, one of your arguments, and you make a lot of good arguments, deals with, if I may, the almost idiosyncratic reaction. That allergy doesn't affect that many people. And yet I note that the FDA has, I think, passed rules or proposed rules right now that, and milk producing doesn't, you know, in other words, there's nothing on the carton that says, you are advised that this contains lactose and warning, lactose intolerance may cause allergies which are dangerous to your health. That's what the FDA is either proposing or has passed. I'm not sure of the status. I have the Federal Register from July 30th of 1999 here. And when the Food and Drug Administration, this is just a sense, but when the Food and Drug Administration thinks that the problem is severe enough that it's going to require warnings on every single glove, it seems to me that we're not just talking about lactose intolerance.
We are talking about the same principles, and let me note, Justice Bradley, that at the time in question, the FDA did not have the knowledge any more than we had the knowledge, because the state of the scientific knowledge at the time did not permit it to put such warning on its products. Let me say that where the law condemns products that are defective and unreasonably dangerous, it is astonishing that the Court of Appeals would, or any court would, attempt to reduce the test to a one-factor test in all cases as a matter of law to determine whether a product, an action, a suspicion, an amount of attorney's fees, or almost anything else in the law is reasonable or unreasonable. The law typically requires consideration of all of the various relevant circumstances. In other words, a contextual inquiry. And in the design defect case, this means that you look at the product and you ask, was the product designed to be reasonably safe given all the circumstances? And those circumstances include, in appropriate cases, the types of things that the court was talking about on page 372 of the Sumner case. Let me also address very briefly a third and independent error that the lower courts made. They expressly told the jury to disregard one of the Sumner factors, our inability to know of the risk of latex allergy. That, too, is unprecedented. The Sumner case says that the ability of the manufacturer to eliminate danger is highly relevant. Consider the 1979 Christie case in which the court said that a product was not defectively designed because human knowledge had not yet developed the technology that could eliminate the danger. Well, in our case, human knowledge had not even developed the ability to perceive the danger. Fourth and finally, the Court of Appeals so fundamentally misunderstood the question of defect in this case that it concluded the plaintiff's key witness on defect offered harmless testimony. This is the erroneous admission of the supposed expert testimony of Paul Cascioli that our gloves were unsafe. He is employed by a competing manufacturer. Even the Court of Appeals recognized the centrality of this testimony to the plaintiff's case, and that Cascioli was not qualified to give it. But the Court of Appeals thought that the error was harmless because it thought that other evidence supported Cascioli's view. It never asked whether there was a reasonable possibility that Cascioli's testimony contributed to the final result. And had the Court of Appeals asked the correct question, it would have had to reverse.
Ms. Olson, Karen,
go ahead.
I started out my questioning, aren't you really asking us to adopt restatement torts third? And I still think you are. I mean, under our current law, you know, some of us grew up on Dipple and what the five factors are. Some of us were already grown up, I suppose, when Dipple came. But there's no difference in the standard jury instruction, the way these products cases for years have gone to the jury. You have the five factors of Dipple set forth in the standard jury instruction, and it doesn't break down with regard to difference in the manufacturing process and difference in design the way that our law currently exists. Now, if we adopt restatement thirds and impose in 2 sub B the design defect, this reasonable expectation, rather reasonableness, was the conduct reasonable, foreseeable, I guess is the phrase, then that is a change. But as the law has been for years, since 67 in Dipple, there hasn't been, it's been the five factors. That's what you gave to the jury, that's what you had to show as an attorney, that's what you had to defend against as an attorney. So tell me that you're not asking us to adopt the restatement of Ford's third. Hmm? That just really seems like you are.
May I respond to that even though my
certainly
time is up?
We
are not asking the court to adopt the restatement third. We are arguing about at least one and possibly 2 of the 5 Dipple factors. We are arguing about what constitutes a defect, and if you want to collapse that together with what constitutes unreasonable danger, then we are talking about both of them. If you conclude that current Wisconsin law, and I'm not sure how you could conclude this given the Prisky case, given the Sumner case, given the Glassy case, given the Sharp case, if you conclude that current Wisconsin law does not accept our theory, then I do believe that it would be time to change Wisconsin law. But we need no change in Wisconsin law. We are here not because of the restatement third. We are here because of Sumner, all of Sumner, not just one sentence in Sumner.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Campus, representing Linda Green.
May it please you, Madam Chief Justice, may it please you, members of the court. Having practiced in the trenches for over 30 years in products liability law, and having served as an advisor of the American Law Institute's study of products liability third, restatement third, it should come as no surprise to you that my view of products liability law in Wisconsin differs from Professor Kearney's. And I agree with you, Justice Bradley, that is exactly what they are asking you to do, and that is to scuttle 30 years of products liability law in Wisconsin that has served the state well and adopt various aspects of products liability third, including the elimination of strict liability from design defect cases. When they talk in their briefs about foreseeability, they're talking about a negligence element. They're talking about an element of negligence, foreseeability of risk. And when they suggest that in Wisconsin strict liability cases should incorporate foreseeability of risk in strict liability, in effect is what they're saying is like products liability restatement third, eliminated strict liability in design cases. Right now it only applies according to the products liability restatement third in manufacturer defect cases. When they ask you to find in design cases risk utility, that's precisely what the restatement, third products liability, says, that you should eliminate consumer expectation and adopt risk utility evaluations as the main test in design cases. And, of course, to establish a prima facie case under design cases, plaintiffs have to establish a reasonable alternative design. The fact is that the law of products liability in Wisconsin has been fair, even-handed, and has worked fine. There is no clamor among Wisconsin manufacturers or people who sell products in Wisconsin to change Wisconsin law. Wisconsin products liability law, members of the court, as practice, is not a walk in the park. These are not easy cases. As noted in recent cases by this court, there are five elements that you must prove under strict liability. And the five elements are that it was defective when it left the manufacturer, that it's unreasonably dangerous to the user or consumer, and that's a separate element, that the defect caused the injuries, that the seller is engaged in the business of selling the product, and that the product resulted in no substantial change from the time it left the manufacturer to the time it reached the ultimate consumer. In the recent case of Sharp, you, Chief Justice, described unreasonably dangerous as a quantum of danger more than that required in a negligence case, which has been my experience as well at practicing products liability law. And Justice Prosser stated in the Morden case, in a negligent action, it's not necessary to show condition of product reached the level of unreasonable dangerousness. So there's always been a distinction in this court's mind for 30 years between negligence cases as a basis for product defect design and strict liability. Strict liability 402A, as in the Dippo case, is applied equally to manufacturing defects and design defects. And there have been a number of cases, members of the court, where plaintiffs have been unsuccessful in this state, even with the application of consumer expectation, by virtue in part of the adoption of a negligence per se label, which doesn't make it negligence, but allows comparative negligence to be used in strict liability cases, which is not true in all states. Nor is it true in California that unreasonable dangerousness is one of the factors, because they feel that's too harsh a burden. For instance, in Shue, the trial court was correct in holding the plaintiff contributory negligent more so than the defendant, and the plaintiff did not recover. Consider Vincer, the swimming pool case, in which the court held that consumer expectation would not apply because it was obvious to the person that the locking device, which was claimed as not having it as a defect, was open and obvious, that they were able to observe it. There was no recovery. Yes, ma'am.
If I may.
Sure.
Your opposing counsel stresses the point that the jury instruction here was wrong, but the jury was instructed incorrectly because the court relied exclusively on the consumer expectation test, both with regard to unreasonableness and with both with regard to unreasonably dangerous and with regard to defect, and cites language from Sumnick in support of the proposition that Wisconsin is not wedded just to the consumer expectation test, that is at pages 371 to 372, indicating that Wisconsin has refrained from adopting mandatory factors. I assume you're familiar with that.
Yes, I am.
How do you respond to that argument?
Sumnick clearly did not change Wisconsin law. It did not modify consumer expectation law. If so, it would have said so. Justice Cece, who wrote the opinion in Sumnick, clearly set forth there's a risk utility test and there's a consumer expectation test, and he said we are committed to consumer expectation. Then further on in the opinion, he discusses some factors that were cited in Collins versus Ridge Tool. And looking at Collins versus Ridge Tool, you'll see that they're citing these factors from the Hobart case, which is the negligence case. Those factors, I suggest, are negligence factors, although some of them can be utilized in a strict liability case. For instance, one that the professor referred to, in those factors, ability to eliminate danger without impairing the product's usefulness. That's a factor that can be used in a strict liability case to define defect. And in this case, as a matter of fact, there was testimony from the defense experts that removal of high proteins from these gloves would not have affected the utility of the gloves, would not have affected the usefulness of the gloves. Prisky is another case, Greitens is another case, the state of Schilling, Glassy is a case where there's substantial changes, where the Wisconsin strict liability, despite the use of consumer expectation, did not result in a plaintiff's recovery. Restatement Third has not been adopted explicitly since its adoption by any court in this country. It has been roundly criticized by scholars and writers and by some courts who have rejected it. Let me just depart from this, and I'll get back to the law in Wisconsin, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Just before you start, you agree, though, don't you, that the jury instructions here, both as to defect and unreasonably dangerous, relate to the consumer expectation test?
Absolutely.
And no other test in the jury
instructions? There is no other test in Wisconsin other than the 32-6.
And there are no jury instruction in this case as to any other.
Not only that, I think it was asked earlier by Justice Bradley, they did not ask in the trial court for an instruction for risk utility, but let me advise the court that despite this fact, the record is filled with evidence of the utility of these gloves. It was argued by Mr. Peterson to a large extent that these gloves have saved people from AIDS, from other blood-borne diseases, that they're useful, they're wonderful, they have a social purpose. The jury heard all this. They heard the utility and the benefits of protective barriers and the gloves that provide these protective barriers. So despite there was no risk utility, the jury heard all the utility that a jury would have heard under any circumstances with respect to the gloves. Let me just talk about this product just a minute. This was not an attack on all latex gloves. This was an attack on Smith and Nephew gloves. There was a finding by the jury that they were defective, unreasonably dangerous, upheld by the trial court and the Court of Appeals. That is not an issue before this court. The court, I respectfully suggest, should look at this case as if these products have been found as defective and unreasonably dangerous. They were excessively high in proteins. The evidence showed that in 1982, the manufacturer changed the manufacturing process that had been designed to eliminate impurities, that several steps were removed. The result that when these gloves were tested by the Mayo Clinic, they had 100 times the level of allergenic proteins than 10 out of 13 gloves. In other words, state-of-the-art evidence came in as well. When Ansel took over Smith Nephew, they were charged with reducing the levels. It was an easy process. Wash them with H2O. And they've reduced the protein levels by 90%. Yes, Justice Presser.
I think you just said a moment ago that the manufacturing process was changed in 1982.
Yes.
The manufacturer that changed the process in 1982, was that the defendant in this case?
No, it was an explanation of how the gloves became defective. They didn't know. When they made the change, we don't know why they made the change, whether it was to save money or what, but at that time the change resulted in an elimination of a washing process that had to do with removing impurities, and one of the impurities that was left on were these proteins in excess levels. So it was an explanation of why these gloves and other gloves were different, and that's why that evidence came in.
Why should the defendant here be held responsible for maintaining a process that was changed before they took over the company?
We're not attacking the manufacturer, Justice Prosser, for changing the manufacturing process. What it resulted was in a product that was defective and unreasonably dangerous to healthcare workers to the extent that has been described as an epidemic, to the extent that it's described as an occupational hazard. This latex allergy to these members of the court is not sniffles and teary eyes. This is an allergen that was described by an expert as the most potent allergenic protein that they've ever experienced in their professional careers. This is a disease which is life-threatening if you suffer anaphylactic events. This is a disease that has affected anywhere from 5 to 17% of healthcare workers in this country. It has ended careers. This is a disease that causes occupational asthma, which affected the plaintiff, and she had to move out of her job into another area of health care. So this is a very serious disease. Yes?
And it obviously was with this person, but the estimates of the people affected, is that very serious or the minor sniffles?
Say again, I'm sorry.
The 5 to 17% of people that might be affected, is that people severely affected or everything from severe down to sniffles?
That includes people who have latex allergy, and not all people go on to anaphylactic episodes or occupational asthma. There's no question about that. Yes, just
one other question in that same area. So people that use these gloves, and as I recall the facts, they take them off 40, 50 times a day, and they have a reaction. And most reactions, and I don't want to misstate the facts, are not as severe as the Chief Justice was relating to. But they can switch to other, I don't know, vinyl gloves, other gloves that have less protein, and continue with the career. This was, I think, the argument that you're using here is basically that there was a substantial number of the population. If you use your opposing counsel's figures, it was 5%. Your figures may be 17%, but that's still substantial when you look at
Yes, it's clearly not idiosyncratic.
Right. Okay.
This is clearly not a situation that you'd call the victims what you would call them unusually susceptible. This is not a fact situation that the unusually susceptible defense would apply or idiosyncratic. They attempt to make this woman look like the idiosyncratic people that get allergic from cosmetics or from hair styling material. Those cases are cases involving where there is no proof of defect. Our case, there was proof of defect. So those cases have no bearing upon this situation was all. And the plaintiff was not atopic. She was not allergic. Her doctor, treating doctor, testified that she did not have a genetically predisposition to latex allergy, so she was not this accident waiting to happen.
Could I ask you a question?
Yes,
the manufacturing process was changed in 1982, and as a result of that, the protein level was higher in the gloves. Suppose the manufacturing process had not been changed. How do we know what the impact on the plaintiff would have been?
The testimony in this case was that that gloves with allergenic proteins as high as Smith Nephew constituted a significant risk of harm to the users, that gloves with low protein levels did not, that she would not have been affected in all probability by gloves with low proteins, and that many glove manufacturers, such as Ansel, had very low proteins. And remember, from the record, that the American College and American Academy of Allergists published a warning to users that they should use only low-protein gloves. And so the evidence was overwhelming that it was Smith-Nephew gloves, not latex gloves generally, that were defective and unreasonably dangerous. With respect to the instructions, the elimination of the product was not reasonably fit language. There was no allegation here that the product didn't serve its purpose as barrier protection. It did. This wasn't a case in which someone got AIDS because there were holes in the gloves. These gloves were fit for the purpose, just like asbestos provided an adequate insulation while it was harming people. These gloves were adequate for that aspect of it, and so removing that particular language certainly did not affect any rights of the defendant.
The difference in the asbestos cases is that there was evidence out there that asbestos was dangerous.
After a time, there was, Chief Justice, but there were many people injured by asbestos before it became known why asbestos caused mesothelioma and asbestosis. And this case is a perfect example of why strict liability has a proper rationale. Because here's a latent defect which causes harm, and this latent defect, the plaintiff can only recover under strict liability in Wisconsin under consumer expectation. Because if the court were to adopt the law, which is proposed by Restatement Third, that strict liability only applies in manufacturing defect cases and not in product design cases, we will be unable to prove foreseeability of harm. But that hasn't stopped this court in prior cases from allowing plaintiffs to recover where the risk of harm existed in the product and there's no necessity to prove foreseeability. The cases are filled with that language in Wisconsin, that foreseeability is not a factor in strict liability cases. All you have to do is prove those five elements and you're home.
Counsel, I want to address the kind of defect this is.
Okay.
Now, under Wisconsin laws that currently exist, does it make any difference whether this is designated a design defect or a manufacturing defect?
That's true.
I'm asking
you, Wisconsin law, strict liability applies to both.
And the jury instructions apply, you don't say whether it's design defect or manufacturing defect. Yet you talk about this being a hybrid defect.
It really is, and I'll explain again why, although we said it in our brief. A design defect case is a case in which there's a design of the product, and all the products have the same design, and the plaintiff is criticizing that design. In this case, there was no design to manufacture these gloves with high protein. There was no design criteria where Smith Nephew said, we are going to design our gloves with excessively high protein. At the same time, there was no manufacturing specifications which said, we shall design our product with low protein levels. So there wasn't a deviation of a manufacturing specification in the sense that the quality control somehow failed in the inspection of the product. Process. In other words, they designed a manufacturing process which resulted in a end product that was unreasonably dangerous and defective to the user and the consumer beyond that which they contemplated. And what did they contemplate? The user contemplated that although the glove would protect us against blood-borne diseases, it would make us sick. And so the contemplation is not the level of proteins or how the gloves were manufactured, it's the contemplation that it wasn't safe. And just as a list of the kind of products that consumer expectation has been applied to in Wisconsin, seatbacks in Sumnick, electricity in Ransom and the Beacon Bowl, pool table legs in Dipple, concrete in Netzel, lawnmower blades in Howe, fire engine wheels in City of Franklin, swimming pool gates in Vincer, printing presses in Greiton, gas can caps in Keller, defective TVs in Black, front end loader brakes in Prisky, and I could go on and on. Electricity is a heck of a lot more complicated, and Sumnick seat back is a lot more complicated than gloves. These are not just used by healthcare workers, these are used by housekeepers and housepersons, just in normal household duties. And so what is contemplated, what has gone beyond the contemplation of the user here, is that the gloves won't make me sick. And it's the contemplation of the safety of the product which has been exceeded here, and why the consumer contemplation and expectation test is an appropriate test in this particular case.
Counsel, in this particular situation, if you're claiming a design defect, was there a duty to warn?
There was no duty to warn, Justice Crooks, because there was no knowledge of risk that they could have warned. In other words, she was one of the unfortunate few, just like in the area of thalidomide, asbestos, toxic shock caused by tampons, that got sick before people realized why they were getting sick. And if you eliminate the ability to recover under strict liability, where there's a group of people who get sick before people realize why they're getting sick, and you require plaintiffs to prove foreseeability of harm, you've eliminated strict liability. You've created what the restatement wants to create, is recovery only where there is negligence, except for, quote, manufacturing defect cases. So there are latent defects which exist in products which cause harm where strict liability is particularly designed to apply to. And the social bases of strict liability, which this court recognized in DIPL and has been recognized ever since, is that when a manufacturer puts a product into the marketplace, whether it's due to manufacturing defects or design defects, whether it has defects that are known or unknown, and the consumer expects not to be hurt by them and expect them to be safe, that's the expectation, and they're harmed, that the cost of that injury should be borne by the producer or seller that puts it into the marketplace.
Where do you see knowledge entering into the area of products liability?
Negligence, sir.
Strictly in terms of
negligence? In terms of negligence as a basis for product defect. And there are several cases where strict liability was not used, but negligence was used, where lack of ordinary care, you've got duty, you've got breach, and also the warning cases. If you proceed on a warning case, you've got you say no or ought to have known, actual or constructive knowledge. And in that instance, foreseeability is the factor. But in case after case after case, the Wisconsin court for the last 30 years has reiterated, negligence is different than strict liability. One's a horse, one's a zebra. They're not the same. They have different quantums of proof. They have different elements of proof. And this was exclusively a strict liability case. And as much as Smith Nephew and POAC would like to inject negligence into this case because we can't recover under negligence or under warning, they can't, because that isn't what this case is all about.
Well, warning may come up. You now know that protein on these latex gloves may cause difficulties. It would seem to me that, on the other hand, there are gloves that would prevent blood-borne disease. Therefore, you know all that, and if you put a warning, you might prevent liability, wouldn't you?
Well, there is now a warning on latex glove boxes, which says if you are allergic to latex, don't use latex gloves. That sort of goes under the duh, you know. But that's the warning that they have now. And you're correct, if this wasn't such a big deal, the FDA would not have gotten involved. And this business about this California case, by the way, that's on appeal. That was the trial court who said that they don't think they should apply consumer expectation to latex gloves for whatever reason he felt. That's on appeal. All matters have been stayed on that, so we don't know how that's going to come down in the future. As far as the witness, Caccioli, let me just say a couple words about
it. You have approximately five minutes to go.
I don't think I need 5 minutes. If I'm an expert by qualifications, and I say I'm really not an expert because I'm unduly modest, that doesn't unmake my expertise. If I'm not an expert by qualifications, and I say, but I am an expert, that's not going to make me into an expert. This witness was an expert in quality control and manufacturing. The only quarrel that they have with what he said is he said that the gloves were unsafe. Unsafe. Now, what did come before the jury members of the court is that he proceeded with a change in the manufacturing which reduced the protein levels by 90% by just washing it with water. Again, you don't have to be a scientist to figure out that the reason he did that was because they were not safe. Otherwise, why do it? That may also come under another heading of duh. And so that evidence, and the evidence of the plaintiff's expert, was that they were defective and unreasonably dangerous. The experts for the defense all admitted that gloves with low proteins were better and safer. And so even, I don't think it was there. I disagree with the Court of Appeals that this guy wasn't an expert, even though he wanted to say he wasn't. He was. But that unsafe statement by him was in a sea of evidence that these gloves were defective and unreasonably dangerous. It's a ripple in this case, and had no effect whatsoever on the outcome, nor could it, but the test by the Court of Appeals that it didn't affect the substantial rights of the defendants was a correct finding. So if this court agrees that he shouldn't have said unsafe, that all the evidence, which we cited in our brief, makes it harmless because the jury had an awful lot of evidence from which they could have made that finding.
Now, Mr. Habish, I know that what you want and your client want, of course, is an affirmance. But how would you recommend that this court write its brilliant products liability case relating to defective design for future defective design cases?
You're asking me to help you write the opinion?
Absolutely, and I'm going to ask Mr. Kerman
that. I've got some free time next week.
Right. Free legal services.
You know, I said this was a hybrid, and I maintain this is a hybrid. It isn't a classical design case. This isn't a classical manufacturing defect case, but it shows the wisdom of the Wisconsin law, which states that strict liability, 402A, consumer expectations, comment I, comment G, applies to both. So it really doesn't make any difference whether this is a product defect as far as design or product defect as far as manufacturing defect. The same law applies. So with respect to the court, in my view, the court can look at Sumnick. It doesn't say what Professor Kearney says it says. It didn't say that. Nor have any of the cases since Sumnick quoted Sumnick as modifying consumer expectation to incorporate risk utility factors or foreseeability factors. What they're saying, members of the court, is Sumnick somehow has now injected foreseeability of harm into consumer expectations, or risk utility analysis into consumer expectation. And it clearly didn't do that, nor has any court since Sumnick interpreted Sumnick in that way. The only one that interprets it in that way are these people.
Well, what shall we put in something that the relevant factors are conformity of the defendant's design to the practices?
Well, we, as a matter of fact, in this case, introduced that it didn't conform to the state of the art. And so I think that if you look at some of the factors in Sumnick, can they be used in a consumer expectation case where the question is defect, ability to eliminate the danger without impairing the product? I think that's a factor that can come in under consumer expectation, and in fact it did in this case.
But the jury was precluded from considering it. And also, the Court of Appeals opinion in this case stands for the proposition that it cannot consider that, and that the exclusive test for defect and unreasonably dangerous is consumer expectation to the exclusion of everything else. And if that is allowed to stand as the law, that is a departure from past.
Justice Sykes, I agree with your observation, but there's a difference between what comes in as evidence on the issue of what is a defect and what is instructed with respect to what the jury is to consider as the law.
Sure, I understand that. But if they're not instructed as to how to weigh and balance it, they're not going to know what to do.
And
if they're instructed in a way that withdraws from their consideration something that is proper under the law for them to consider, then we've got an invalid verdict.
Well, the judge did instruct the jury that where the gloves were reasonably safe for the use as intended, they're not defective.
I thought that's what was taken out of the instruction.
No, that was part of the instruction. That was added over our objection at the end, where the trial court did instruct them that where the glove is reasonably safe for normal use, the glove cannot be found defective. That was part of the instruction that was added after the court had sustained our request that the reasonably fit part comes out of there. And so the jury was instructed on the law, and keep in mind, that I'm sure you have, that the defendants never asked for this in the trial court, nor did Smith and Nephew at the Court of Appeals suggest that consumer expectation should be scrapped for risk utility. It is here for the first time that they have asked for a change in Wisconsin law to scrap consumer expectation and adopt risk utility. Now, we're here, so that didn't bother the court when the petition for review was requested, but I think it is an important factor to consider. Now, we can only try the case under the actions taken by people at the trial and certainly at the Court of Appeals level. So, in closing, Wisconsin product liability law has served us well. It has not been a stampede for liability against Wisconsin businesses. There is no justification, however, the Product Liability Advisory Council would like this court to gut Wisconsin law just to satisfy Smith and Nephew in this case, and we ask the court to affirm the jury verdict and the Court of Appeal judgment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Habersh. Mr. Kearney. Mr. Kearney, where will we find the jury instructions on...
You will find them on... in the respondent's appendix.
It's 30. Appendix 30.
Pardon me, you will find them in our appendix, Your Honor. Starting on page 28. With regard to the FDA, to this day, the FDA has not banned or regulated protein levels. To this day, the FDA does not permit glove manufacturers with lower protein levels to claim that their gloves are safer than anyone else's gloves. Second, Mr. Habish is incorrect in suggesting that the process was changed in 1982 for some reason to do with impurities. The process was changed in 1982 for other reasons. Third, Mr. Habish is quite incorrect in suggesting that the jury was somehow permitted to consider anything other than consumer contemplations. The jury was instructed with regard to defect and with regard to unreasonable danger that the only thing that mattered was consumer expectations. But there is one thing on which Mr. Habish is quite correct. Mr. Habish has told you that the Sumnick factors can be used in some strict liability cases. But what cases? He has no theory as to when the Sumnick factors can be used, other than not this case. How could I have misrepresented the Sumnick case? I quoted from the Sumnick case. Unless reading from pages 371 to 375 of the Sumnick case then is a misrepresentation, then we have done nothing other than quote back to the Wisconsin Supreme Court what the Wisconsin Supreme Court had to say.
Well, with all due respect, it seems to me that maybe that paragraph is in the right wrong spot that you keep quoting, because it looks like unreasonably dangerous rather than defect. I agree with you that it's at the end of the defect clause, but it's after they say, well, in Wisconsin it's consumer expectation. So I found that a little confusing myself as I reread it. I joined that opinion and I didn't obviously object to that. Don't now, but I do find it a little confusing.
Your Honor, the paragraph that begins on page 371 says, this court has refrained from adopting mandatory factors that must be weighed when determining if a product is defective and unreasonably dangerous. Since product defects are unique in each
totally
case.
I totally agree. I totally agree with you.
I'm sorry?
I said I agree with you.
Yes.
I read that.
If all that matters is consumer expectations, why was there a trial in this case? The jury should have been instructed to go in and answer two questions only, causation and damages, because there is no dispute that we could not have known of latex allergy, and therefore we never claimed that the plaintiff could have known of latex allergy.
Well, Mr. Kearney, isn't that the whole point about strict liability? The question is, who's going to bear this? Whether the manufacturer that puts the product in the stream of commerce, that's going to make money out of it, it should bear the risk, or the one person who's severely injured.
That's
the whole point about strict liability.
That is one of the points about strict liability. But as this court has said previously, before you can get into an analysis of risk spreading, it first has to be established that there was a defect in the product. So you don't get to risk spread simply for the sake of risk spreading. You get to risk spread only if a manufacturer made a defective product. And the restatement second, not the restatement third, the restatement second makes clear that products that cause allergic reactions are to be handled, if at all, under strict liability law, on a duty-to-warn theory. Plaintiff could not proceed on a duty-to-warn theory. Plaintiff conceded that. So plaintiff has asked this court to make new Wisconsin law.
Restatement recognizes that where there's a substantial, and it doesn't say what substantial is, people that do have an allergic reaction, that you have a defect problem, and that it's unconnected with duty-to-warn. That's one of the comments.
5 to 17% of the relevant population was sensitized. By plaintiff's own evidence, 40% of those 5 to 17% experienced only very minor symptoms. And the vast majority of the rest experienced also very minor symptoms. May I have another moment or two, Your Honor? Thank you.
And then I'm going to ask you to write the opinion first.
I appreciate that. I will welcome the opportunity. With regard to reasonable fitness, Mr. Havish claims that this does not belong in this case, but if you look at the Fourth Amended complaint, paragraph 115A, you will see that one of the bases on which the plaintiff claimed in this case that our gloves were unreasonably dangerous and defective because of the content and release of the aforementioned allergens which cause latex hypersensitivity, said latex gloves were unsafe for normal use and not reasonably fit for the ordinary purposes for which they were sold and intended to be used. With regard to the state of the precedents, the state of the precedents makes quite clear that on numerous times this court, not only in the Sumner case, not only on the pages of the Sumner case that I have cited, has considered the proposition with regard to reasonableness. The Keller case, you can look at 88 Wisconsin 2nd at 32, and you will see that the product at issue here was not as safe as was reasonably possible. With regard to foreseeability, the Sumner case refers several times to the importance of foreseeability.
Okay, tell us how you're going to write the opinion.
The opinion could be written very easily in one of two ways. The cleanest way would be to hold tightly to the existing Wisconsin law as stated in the diversity cases, in particular the Edelman-Tremblay case, and to say that
federal courts interpreting
Wisconsin law and say that where a product is causes allergy, the product is not defective unless there is a duty to warn and a failure to fulfill that duty. That would be the cleanest, most straightforward way to address this case without getting into the more far-reaching questions of Wisconsin products liability law. If you get into those questions, the opinion is not much more difficult to write. All the court has to say is that it is evidence on the face of this record that the jury was limited only to considering consumer contemplation with regard to both defect and unreasonable danger. Under Sumner, a jury should get to consider all of the circumstances in holding whether a product is defective and unreasonably dangerous. See 121 Wisconsin 2nd at 371 to 372, reversed and remanded.
But in that case, the pattern instruction is no good either, because the pattern instruction doesn't tell the jury about those other factors that it's putting.
No, the pattern instruction talks about reasonably fit for its ordinary purposes, which is why I was pointing out a moment ago that it was the plaintiff that brought that into the case by alleging in its Fourth Amended complaint, paragraph 115A, that that's one of the reasons that our product was defective. Reasonably fit for its ordinary purposes encompasses more than whether the gloves were able to act as barrier protectors. It enables the jury to take into account all the evidence that Mr. Peterson did bring up and that Mr. Havish points to bringing up, but the jury was never permitted to consider it.
And how is that different from a product is not defective if it is safe for normal use, apart from the fact that that doesn't say much. A product is defective if it is, or is not defective if it is safe. But how does what's in the pattern instruction differ from that?
The pattern instruction differs from that in the sense that when you also look at the fact that a sentence was added into the instructions about our lack of knowledge, the jury was told expressly to disregard one of the key Sumnick factors, which is whether or not the manufacturer had the ability to eliminate the danger. The lack of knowledge instruction is a separate error under Sumnick that also entitles us to reversal and a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Tierney. Thank you, Mr. Havish. That concludes our hearing on 98-2162, Green versus Smith and Nephew AHP. The court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45.